Hello, and welcome back to Dealing with Doing Good, a limited audio series produced by the team at Commonplace. In this series, we explore the challenges and meanings of doing good in a complicated world. In each episode, we sit down with people who are trying to make a living in the world of development. Join us as we discuss with our guests the motivations, anxieties, and realizations which drive them. I'm your host, Nishtha Tiwari, an interdisciplinary researcher and co-founder of Commonplace. In our first episode, we discussed mental health in the workspace. Today, we are moving on to another theme close to our hearts. We will be speaking about discourses of sustainability, the environment, and our personal emotions when we work on these issues. For today's discussion, our guest is Sheba Thesaur. Sheba is a researcher working in the fields of human geography and political ecology. She also has a decade of practitioner experience working with nonprofits on issues of environmental and social justice. Hi, Sheba.
Hi, Nishtha. Hi, Kapil.
So, Sheba, we just want to discuss today what kind of work you're doing, what interested you about this work, and what's brought you here.
I recently finished my second master's, which was in human geography. Before that, I have worked for 9 years with different nonprofit organizations and women groups on environmental and social justice issues. My entry point into this work was my interest in forest governance issues. Looking at forest as a contest space where different places of power were having a huge impact on both the human and the non-human aspects of the space. So there was a specific incident that brought me to this work. During my first master's, I was doing an internship in a strictly protected area in a tiger reserve. I was doing an extensive household level survey on human-wildlife conflict for a prominent wildlife conservation organization. There were two things that happened during this internship. One was that although many environmental NGOs look at local people in protected areas as a disturbance, there are always efforts going on for relocation of people from tiger reserves. I could still see patterns of coexistence and a very different way of looking at and living life amongst the people that were staying there. So there was more of coexistence than conflict. And the other incident was this specific encounter when a woman refused to just answer my questions. She said that people come, they ask questions and leave, but our situation of precarity stays the same. There was a lot of hurt in her face when she refused. And I still remember that I couldn't stop crying for a while after that because I felt that she was right in so many ways. I wanted to do better. I wanted to not be involved in just extractivist research, but something that would facilitate a sort of intervention. So that's how I got into the space here.
Okay. Yeah, those are some very poignant answers, I must say. Shiva, I think that's sort of the motivation which has brought a lot of us also together to do this podcast. And I just wanted to talk a bit more about that feeling you mentioned of not wanting to do extractivist research, because a lot of us work in a sector which comes from a philosophy which in some senses can be very extractivist, and with the idea of doing good. So the idea is that because you're doing good, it's okay to sort of go in with this top-down lens, ask questions of people, gather information, gather insights, and then go back and do these interventions. And you also spoke of doing something which can help make things better. So how do you balance those two feelings, that feeling of wanting to do good and wanting to do it within the location where we're working, and the other of the way that the sector itself is organized and the way that ideologies and funding sort of works from a top-down way. And maybe you can start from there and we'll go deeper into the questions that we want to explore.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very important aspect of the nonprofit sector. The philosophy and the actual practice of it and the contradiction between the two. And I don't think that anyone has ever been able to resolve it completely, except some people when they say that they are completely extracting themselves out of the sector and doing work at their own level. But I don't think that that can always be the solution to doing things. And accepting the role of the nonprofit sector and at the same time trying to find ways to change the functioning of it to make it more relational, to make it more mindful of the impact it's having on the people and the people that we are representing and the people who are involved in this representation. I think that could be a first step. But I'm also as confused and as lost about these questions as you are. So,
yeah, no, I think, yeah, I think centering that feeling of confusion is very important, because a lot of the times, especially when it comes to ideas of sustainable development, they're often spoken about in a way that seems like everybody has a lot of clarity, right? Like, these are the SDG goals. This is what needs to be done. These are the things that we need to fix in the next 15 years for things to get better. Whereas when we go on the ground, the way that you're talking, that a lot of that there are patterns of coexistence, which challenge these narratives of things that need to be done in a very direct manner. I think that exists for all of us. And so I wanted to talk a bit about today's topic, which is about sustainability in development. So what does that actually mean? Like, what are these ideas of sustainability that seem to be everywhere? Everyone seems to talk about them, but what do they actually mean? And what do they mean specifically for you in your work as well as personally?
So, like, the whole idea of sustainable development discourse, like, came into our vocabulary, as you would know, in the 1980s with United Nations. And the old definition that we were also taught in school was to meet the needs of the present without compromising the capacity of future generation to meet their needs. And it's a simplistic understanding shown with these three overlapping circles of social, environmental, and economic. But it's also a useful idea. It's been leveraged by activists and by nonprofits to protest when some state level or industrial activities just focused on money making without looking at the social justice issues or the impacts of the activity on the environment. So it has been used positively. At the same time, one must admit that a lot that goes on in the name of sustainable development or sustainability narratives, it may have overall negative impacts. And here I'm talking about, for instance, green capitalism, where you see that there is this narrative of economies based on capitalism can continue to grow, and you can turn nature into capital. They can use market-based instruments for solving environmental issues. So overall, I would say that sustainability is an elegant and enticing idea. It really captures your imagination. It also helps you get off the hook, because there's an illusion of control. But it's also fiction, right? It's a story. There's no proof that it actually exists or can ever exist. And it's extremely vague, so it's convenient. A lot of contradicting ways of living, knowing, and doing can be justified under this label.
Just to follow up on that, specific to the Indian context. So again, like you said, a lot of these ideas came up on a global, like through global frameworks to begin with in the 80s and 70s. And how do we think of that in a developing context, especially since you've worked within organizations that are at the grassroots, or they're working even from a mid-level managerial perspective within India? What does that idea of sustainable livelihoods in a developing context mean, as well as how do the narratives of sustainability sort of operate within these countries?
So, like, different NGOs approach this in a very different way. And most of the groups that I have worked with have emphasized on the value of existing ways of living, where your relationship with the environment is very direct, visible, and apparent, like in agriculture, pastoralism, forest-based or coastal livelihoods. So they're looking at what are the traditional institutions that have allowed them to sustain for so long, while also acknowledging some problems within these institutions, but overall highlighting that through collectivization or through networking with activists and nonprofit groups, they have tried to continue to stay mindful of those, say, three overlapping circles of environmental, social, and economic, but also political dimensions. So, like, connectedly, there are then things like community-run, homestay-based, ecologically conscious tourism, or like use of the Forest Rights Act to actually be able to, at a local community level, sell non-timber forest produced to support the local economy. So the idea within all these narratives is that because your life, your culture, your livelihood is so directly and so visibly connected to the state of your environment, you would by default be more mindful and conscious. So you would be more conscious and aware and not do things that are harmful or destructive in the long run as much as you would otherwise. The idea then becomes to highlight these initiatives, to support them, and sometimes also to advocacy where they're threatened. So that's the way in which I have worked with sustainability narratives. But this is just a small portion of actually all that is going on in the name of sustainable livelihoods. And many times sustainability also within my work and within other people's work can become tokenism. Like you would have heard so much about like planting trees or using recycled paper. And there are also these like green capitalism narratives that I mentioned earlier, which also use sustainability. So when you connect this to the global climate change narrative, until a few years ago in India, I would say that climate change as a concept would feel distant. And it still does to a large extent. Like the flood would be immediate, crop failure, an unseasonal behavioral pattern of an animal or a plant. All of that would be there. But that connection in the discourse with climate change was not there so much at the local level articulation, except where there's big money or except where there's active facilitation by some nonprofit or a corporate social responsibility group, or there's a social media activist that articulates it in that way. So you'd also see that in our environmental litigation, in the cases that people file for environment, like most cases don't have climate change as the central argument. So I personally feel that that it's important to acknowledge climate change and all its potential for devastation, but to also acknowledge that this is just one component of an even larger entanglement of our like really problematic relations with human and non-human aspects.
No, that makes complete sense. I think that's a big debate that's actually apparent even when we speak, like attend any climate change forums today, because it seems to be this sort of, that debate seems to be growing bigger, where there's the whole, you know, 1.5 or 2 degree kind of narrative that this is happening and we need to put a stop to it and these things need to be done immediately. And then you have things which are going on in the everyday in countries like India, where historic emissions have been so low. And I think that's a trending, there's this trending tweet right now which has all these historic emissions listed out, because a lot of the climate change debate again seems to have centered on low-income countries who have high emissions today. And I think that narrative of, you know, where have the historic emissions come from? What are the things changing at the everyday level in India? How does that compare against what's already gone on in these other countries for a long time? I think that really complicates the climate change debate. And then when you bring in the human and non-human angle there, there's so much more at play. So I think those are very good points, a lot for thought. Kapil, yes?
Yeah. I found Shiva's, thank you for Shiva. Shiva, I found your kind of structuring for what the challenges are quite interesting, because I had this one incident like during a field visit, and it was something that's always stuck with me because it was it was comical in one sense, but at the same time, it's just extremely sad. So I was visiting a fishing community in Bihar, and I was interviewing this one family. It was a five generation old family, five different generations living in the same roof. They had been living by this lake for a extended period of time. That lake was their primary source of sustenance. It was their primary mode of livelihoods. But what happened over the last 10 years with like the increasing fluctuation in weather is in Bihar, that lake eventually dried out. And that livelihood for them eventually just ended. And I was talking to one particular member, the youngest member, and he was talking about how their family was going through a crisis because there were things that they could do to fix this problem. Like they were thinking about investing money as a community. So within this small village, there were a number of different fish families or small fishing communities that were thinking about pooling their money together and trying to bring manufactured fish production into these dried up ponds and these dried up lakes, because that's what they always did. That's what they always felt like was reliable for them as an income source. But the cost of doing that was so significantly high that it just seemed like a far-fetched dream. So the reason I was there during this visit was actually for a different project. And the focus of that project was looking into young couples and looking into young men particularly and converting them into retail agents, essentially agents who would go from house to house, offer different retail products that family members could purchase. And this was run by a fairly large NGO, and it was a very hallmark project that was being run by one of the big donors. And I always found that contradiction very confusing, that here you had a family who for generations has been dependent upon this very clear natural resource for their livelihoods, and that resource has completely gone, it's vanquished. They're articulating how they could potentially solve that problem through like collectivization, collecting a pool of money and trying to do some artificial fishery growth in those lakes and ponds. But you have these other, as you put it, the development infrastructure not necessarily paying attention to it, rather focusing more from a capitalistic point of view. Is like, hey, it's retail purchases or retail shopping is the new big thing. Everybody has a smartphone. Let's push this audience towards this new livelihood or new source of income. So that as I was kind of listening to you, Shiva, that comparison between what has always been there and what nature exists versus what is being pushed from a capitalistic mindset, that contradiction to me was, I think, the most clearly visible in this one incident. So how do you kind of see this progressing, or how do you kind of feel this complexity playing out in the everyday work that you do?
Thanks, Kapil. And I mean, I think it's a very important point that you brought up. And this thing of capitalist agendas being pushed is there, but there's also this very real need for cash flow, as you said, that even for restoring it, there would be costs. And the environmental NGOs coming in to do the restoration, like in either way, I would say that there is something within it that may not be too sustainable. When you have an external intervention, and you have an external intervention that is needed again and again. So it's just a reality of the situation that money has become important in rural areas too, much more than it was earlier. Cash has become important, and the earlier the common resources that were there and the capacity and the time to do community labor just without money that was there is not there anymore, because you have the choice of like doing collective voluntary community labor or of surviving, and it's not really a choice, it's a compulsion then. So these are just very hard challenges and questions, and there are no solutions that even I see for them.
So how do you deal with some of these emotions? Like, you shared the example of that incident with the lady that didn't want to be interviewed. I think that's a very common scenario with a number of different people working in the social sector might have come across. How do you reckon with those emotions? Or like, just interested to know what type of emotions were you feeling at that time?
Yeah, so the emotions that I have felt through my years has been a big diverse range. I would love to say that I'm 100% motivated and passionate all the time, but it's actually a pendulum that swings between interest and disconnection. Because when I started my work, it was with a great amount of passion and motivation, but after a few years, I started feeling immobilized, because I would feel that whatever we would do would never be enough. And there were so many inherent contradictions between what we talk about and how we live our life, and between the life of myself and the people that I'm representing. So all of these contradictions and these feelings would create a lot of guilt, sadness, inefficacy, and eventually disconnection, then guilt about the disconnection. And like finding ways to reconnect. And I felt that like in my own way of dealing with it, there was a lot of redefining of what activism means for me, what working in an NGO or what even quote unquote doing good means for me. Like, what are my notions of time, how to use time, how to be productive, and how much during all of this I'm also giving attention to my own self while acknowledging that this self is affected by its relations to other. So I think in the end it involved being a little easy on myself, being a little kind to myself also, and being okay with having a very limited role, just believing in what you're doing and trying to do it, at the same time understanding that there are structures that will make it challenging, but these structures may also evolve and change with the small changes that we are doing. So I think that there are still times of hopelessness and helplessness, but there is also a bit more acceptance of not being able to do everything.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that with us, Shiba. I think I did have a chance to go through some of the written works that you've done, and you've also your master's thesis was also about affective states in activism, and I think that follows very well from your answer right now. How much is sort of research, or, you know, thinking about these questions from a theoretical framework or reading what other people have written about this, how has that played a role in the work that you do? How has research sort of affected it outside of the activism or the practitioner work that you're already doing?
Yeah, I think that's really important to talk about research and the nonprofit sector together, because there is a lot of skepticism for academia in the nonprofit sector. And so for the longest time initially, I also found myself not engaging too much with academia. Like, even within these nonprofits, you do research, you do have important observations and connections and analysis, but you're not really in touch with the latest vocabulary and the latest theoretical frameworks and concepts. So you have a few, the ones that make the circles of conferences, but in those conferences, there are always the same people and the same jargon words. So sometimes you can be a bit stuck in your thinking too. What I found about coming back to research was that it gave me some vocabulary to process some of my existing experiences, that there were already some very crucial observations and feelings that had emerged from the experiences of practitioner work, but there wasn't always the vocabulary or the validation that I could find within these nonprofit spaces that I found by analyzing this in relation to the concepts that were being talked about, especially in like queer, Black, feminist literature on emotions, on affect. So all of that really helped me.
Yeah, no, I think that's true for me as well, because I also worked for a while, and now that I'm doing research work on the same thing, it's actually brought a lot of these things that you're like scounging for what exactly is going on. You know, you're not able to place it, you're not able to place yourself, you're not able to make sense of different things which seem very disparate, but once you study them together or you read works which other people have written where they've studied this together, it becomes much more clearer.
For our audiences, can you explain a bit, like, what is this difference between affect and effect?
How I understand affect is our capacity to be influenced by our environment and to influence the environment. So that's the affect. And effect is like with an E, when you say side effects and stuff like that, then it's about just the impact. So it's not about the potential that you carry within you and how that potential also diminishes or increases because of your relation with others.
No, I think that makes complete sense. And maybe you can do like a short snippet about affect itself, because I think affect is precisely one of those concepts which has been so studied so much in research, but it's actually spoken about very little in the practitioner world. I don't know, Shiba, if you'd agree, but for me, that has been the experience. What would you say?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, that within the practitioner world, there is so much focus on the other. And there is not really a focus that much on the self in terms of how yourself is also being impacted by the work that you're doing. There is also focus on intellectualizing the problem rather than admitting that there are emotional dimensions to why you are in favor of or supporting something. So there is a hierarchy in which there is a division between intellectual or mental reasons and emotional reasons, and the mental reasons are put in a priority.
Yeah, agree completely. And also, I think in my observations, that intellectualization also leads to, when you deny the emotional side, there's a lot of, you know, sort of black and white areas associated with the work you're doing. So it's as if that, because this project objective has been defined and it has been defined in an intellectual manner, there can be no questioning of it, because you've distanced yourself from the idea that this could be driven by certain, you know, certain beliefs that you hold or certain emotional ways in which you engage with a problem. And that may be why a boss or a superior or a development agency or a funding agency has defined something in that particular way. And I've seen this like in the work I do, like there's a lot of depoliticization of the objective towards the other that you have and complete negation of the fact that you as an individual also carry so much of that burden of what you're trying to do.
Exactly. And like that is where all this narrative about situated knowledge helps, right? Because then you admit that there is no God's view, God eyes view, or view from nowhere. There is actually our own situated view that we have to acknowledge. We have to acknowledge that intellectualizing it is just a fictional way of saying that there is no bias, but there is always subjectivity. There is always a place where your understanding and your position is coming from.
I actually wanted to go back to something you brought up earlier, which was the coming again from this line that you said right now about the fictional aspect of sustainability. You know, just it's a story that we're telling ourselves. So could you elaborate a bit more on that? What was your idea behind that statement?
I mean, I think that like there is no proof, right? There is, it is an idea. It is an idea, a very romantic idea that there are, first of all, that there are these three separate circles: environment, social, and economic. Like, what does it mean? Are they really separate? Like, whatever we do is economic, is environment, is social. So it is already, all our actions can be looked at from one point of view where they already have all these circles within them. So this thing of separation of the three activities and then bringing them together is just a way of seeing things, and it has been legitimized because that way of seeing things is considered okay. It is considered okay to just focus on one thing at a time, whereas that's not how really our actions have an impact, right? Like everything has an environmental impact, an economic impact, a social impact, and also like other spiritual, cultural, political, different levels of impact. So it's just an idea that makes you feel comfortable, but it is in some ways not something that you know how to realize it, like how to realize this thing of being aware of all the different dimensions at one time. There is no actual guidebook to that. There are sustainable development goals and there are all these organizations working in different ways. But because the overall definition is so large and all-encompassing, you can have anything within it. And that is how it is being co-opted by industries and by sometimes vested interests.
So Shiva, actually, I'm curious, are there, in your experience, I understand oftentimes it's very hard to disconnect these three concepts that you've talked about, but just looking at some potential impactful case studies, are you aware of any organizations that you feel like are potentially closer towards a way of operation which is more practical to the challenges that are being faced in this intellectual sphere? Like, are there any programs or solutions that you feel that you just admire? Would just love to know.
I feel that all organizations are at different steps towards it, and there is a lot of difficulty in saying that one group is doing it right, because everybody is experimenting and we haven't really reached a stage where we can say that we have achieved something very distinctly. It's a space of constant walking and walking towards something. And yes, I do think that some organizations have a more clearer vision of how to do it. And I would say that many of those would be organizations that have worked with the grassroots more and that have tried to live with those contradictions themselves for a long time. So they may be working on different aspects simultaneously, like, for instance, health and environment, and also care for the local people who are trying to just sustain their lives. And it's difficult to have any names here, but I think that organizations that do this work of documenting initiatives are also important. And so, for instance, one process that I have been involved with earlier, which is the Vikalp Sangam process, the Alternatives Confluences process, is trying to also document these initiatives that are moving towards sustainability, and not just sustainability in a mainstream method, in a mainstream narrative, but also just questioning the forms of development in some way or the other. So there are those sort of processes that are happening where they are documenting and trying to bring these different initiatives together to learn from each other. So looking at those initiatives, but like also acknowledging that they have their own limitations. These are very far from becoming a big movement right now. They're still at a level of just an initiative and a process, but they're happening.
Just on the question again of, I think, contradictions, like when you said, you know, working within contradictions. And I think that's drawing on a lot of the things that I have seen in the sector, I think one of the big problems with why people don't want to conflate, why those silos exist or why they don't want to conflate things, is that it makes it more difficult for people to grapple with the idea themselves, right? Like if you leave a thing purely economical, you leave a thing purely environmental, it's much easier to say, do this or don't do this, which might make it difficult to execute, but it makes it easier to plan. I wanted to know your thoughts on that. Is that something that needs to change entirely? Because in a lot of the work I've done, I keep bringing up this idea that, you know, like, we cannot look at it in these silos. We have to think of these problems together. But then from an executioning perspective, it's like, if we do this, it's much easier to execute it. If we do this, it's much faster to do it. And how do we think along those questions in terms of practicing our work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is an absolutely crucial question for all of us to ask who are within the nonprofit sector, of how we resolve our own inherent contradictions of this work. And for me, I think acknowledgement then becomes a step, that acknowledging that this is the aspect of it that I'm working on, not in your narrative itself, in your discourse, when you're writing about it, make the other aspects be completely invisibilized. So you just acknowledge that there are these other aspects. Having them in consideration will bring up these contradictions, and that is how my impact will be limited. So I think that, like, in our narrative, also acknowledging the limitations of our impact, the limits to what we can actually do, and what is it that we are not touching upon, would be a step. So it's about honesty, but it's also about how this honesty then brings and pushes a scope for changing the narrative, so that later on more of this complexity and nuances get brought in, and it becomes easier to plan, execute, when you have these as a mainstream narrative later on. For me, acknowledgement is the only step that I can work on right now, and an acceptance of myself, that acceptance that, okay, this is what I'm focusing on, but that doesn't mean that the other issues don't exist. If I'm, by focusing on this issue, I'm making the other issues worse, then should I be doing this at all? So I think that level of introspection can be possible.
Yeah, I think that's those are helpful, actually, guide marks of how to think about these problems, because I think we all think about them, but then the things you've mentioned right now, acknowledgement, acceptance, and introspection, which of course is something that you can't actually force someone to do it. But I think acknowledgement and acceptance are actually those kinds of things that you can do, you know, like the three A's before you begin the project.
And I also want to point out that, like, we shouldn't individualize this response.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
I think that most of the times what happens, like, for instance, even when there's burnout, like, it's that the person herself, himself, themselves, they have to take care of it. Whereas it's the social situation and it's the nonprofit situation that is creating these emotions and these influences. So you said that we cannot build introspection in, but we can build in some structures for allowing more introspection, for, like, some spaces of checking in with each other, and reflecting on your work every once in a while. Can be built in within the organizational structure and the organizational way of working. And that's why, like, if you have to change the narrative and you have to include yourself in more in the narrative. And that is what I am now focusing on.
I really find this line of thought really interesting, because just to connecting it to some of the earlier discussion we were having around the capitalistic structure you're in, because one of the biggest challenges that I've always kind of seen and I've had to reckon with in my experience of working within the social development infrastructure is you are constricted by what your donors are looking for. You're constricted by what different government wants you to show as impact. So I think that also plays in terms of how honest you can be, and at the same time, the other sustainable side of it, how financially sustainable can you be as an organization if you're not doing this exchange of honesty and credit with different donors and different governments. I know that's entering into more of a political sphere, but I think that's a huge hurdle that I've seen often, especially larger organizations kind of straddle with, like, at what point do you define impact, and at what cost do you want to define impact as? Just to share a very small line of advice that I received from someone recently. So this was someone who was not working in the social impact space. He was actually working in marketing in North America. And he shared the biggest drawback he's often faced with talking with different social development organizations is whenever he comes into a meeting with them, there is a huge emphasis on this grandiose impact that an NGO is making. And he said that it instantly kind of turns him off, because it's just not realistic. If you had a private sector organization come into an investor meeting and start off with these very outlandish statements of we're going to change the world. And of course, there might be some organizations who do that. So, like how you have different private organizations who do that. But not everybody is an Apple, not everybody is an Uber. You have to be realistic to the impact you're making. And oftentimes I feel like that, as this gentleman was also saying, the infrastructure that you're surrounded in kind of pushes you towards these grandiose statements and not necessarily reckon with the honesty, because that honesty comes at a cost. Yeah, that's my two cents rants on this. It's a question that I feel we as an organization, as Commonplace, have also been kind of dealing with, because we don't want to enter into that sphere. But yeah, I don't think there are any easy answers for this.
Yeah. I think Shiba, one last question, which we ask everyone who comes onto this show. That what's one, and just to end on a happier note, because, you know, we've been discussing a lot of more heavy things. What's one memory from the sector, maybe from your academic career, that you think could make a good episode for a sitcom?
So I'm sorry, but like my sitcom would also be with dark humor. Yeah, so I mean, like, for instance, there's this scene of international conferences, right, on sustainability or climate change, and that's like one place where you can see the absolute contradictions playing out, because there's the footprint of all the people that have flown in, there's the tokenist representation of participants, there's the goodie bags, the bottled water, the extensive air conditioning, the hierarchical ways in which people are treated. And like, during all this time, you're talking about environment and justice and care. So like, that's one whole scene, one whole space where you can see in a very comic way and in also a very sad way, like all these contradictions playing out.
Yeah. I remember when I started out, I was also working on a sustainable livelihoods project. And one of the things we had to do was set up a World Environment Day workshop for one government agency. And there was a big showdown right before, because, you know, the water wasn't there and the flowers weren't there, like the cut bouquets. And it just seemed surreal, because you had all these plastic banners, you had standees and everything, like, you know, just laid out. And even in the and then for the photo op, they took out the bottled water, you know, like they placed it away because they didn't want it in the photo op. But they still had all the other things, like they still had the cut bouquets of flowers, they still had the standees and everything. So yeah, I know completely that what you're talking about, and it does show the contradictions quite well. Shiva, I think we'll end here, but what's next for you and for this space? Like, what are your any final thoughts you have on what you're planning to do next, and just generally where you see this work going?
So I think that, like, I have moved from that space of complete burnout to a space where I still see myself engaging, but in a more gentler way, you know, being not completely going towards the glorification of workaholism that is otherwise there. And apart from that, continuing this work of our own voices, like the voices of people who are engaged in nonprofit sector, and what are the need for care for those people themselves, and what are the ways in which at an organizational level and maybe even at a state level we can have more accountability for caring for these sort of care workers. So that's the way I am right now inclined to, and to like answer and like ask these questions through both academic spaces and also through spaces like, for instance, this podcast and other conversations that I'm having with other people of different nonprofit sectors. So I think that this podcast then also becomes a part of the process.
Well, we're glad to hear that. And thank you so much for coming on this today. And I think you've given me a lot to think about, and also a lot of concepts through which I can think about what I have been doing.
Me too. It was lovely talking to you, Shiva.